This is an ABC podcast.
Good morning. Welcome to AM. I'm Sabra Lane. Widespread blackouts along Australia's east coast have been avoided for now, thanks to an extraordinary intervention by the market regulator. Some experts say it's exposed years of government failure to adequately manage the transition away from fossil fuels. It's something the new federal government needs to address urgently, but even with immediate action, it could still take years before we see the benefit. Matt Bamford has this report.
If the energy market of the future is grounded in renewables, Alex Marks from Alloom Energy wants the benefits to flow to as many Australians as possible. His company's technology allows rooftop solar to be shared in apartments.
Strata communities can have it retrofitted to their apartment building. So once it's installed, everyone gets access to solar electricity.
Watching half the nation's power supply teeter on the brink this week, he says it shows a desperate need for better leadership.
I think it's shown that there's just been a lack of federal policy over the past decade, and we have an urgent need to get more generation into the system.
Unprecedented intervention by the market regulator has saved the East Coast from blackouts for now.
It's done.
Done.
And the Albanese government is eager to get back on the front foot, signing off on a 43% cut in carbon emissions by 2030. Climate and Energy Minister Chris Bowen promised a stable transition.
He will provide the framework for renewable energy for storage and transmission, creating hundreds of thousands of jobs across the country.
Credit Suisse energy analyst Saul Kavonic wants to see incentives for investment.
Going forward, I think we need to see policy which still sees a strong role for market signals, but does so in a way where there's a framework where there's confidence to invest across the spectrum and remains technology agnostic, where one of those price signals factors in decarbonisation.
Putting a price on carbon has been politically poisonous, but Joshua Stabler from Energy Edge says it would help.
I wish we could go back in time and just let those carbon schemes that we planned in 2009 and 2010 just be here. They were good schemes for giving a carbon a price, which would help with transition under these circumstances.
Major industry players are already voting with their feet. BHP announced the closure of Mount Arthur, New South Wales' largest coal mine, by 2030. And Joshua Stabler says the present strain will also accelerate the transition.
It's a market signal for new entrants. It's saying that we have prices that will create value for a new entrant to join this market. The primary beneficiary of these high prices is going to be renewables and batteries, not coal and gas. So coal and gas will now be competing with more renewables in, say, 5 years' time than what they would have had this event not occurred.
In the meantime, Australians will continue to look to government to steer the way. Saul Kavonic says it's not going to happen overnight.
It's taken 5 to 10 years of poor policy in order to get us to this point, and it's going to take 5 to 10 years of good policy to actually put us in a structurally sustainable trajectory again.
Credit Suisse analyst Saul Kavonic ending Matt Bamford's report. While analysts are flagging the energy grid fix could take years, there are hopes the Albanese government will speed up the slow-moving transition to electric vehicles. But there are doubts the government's current policies will do much to shift the dial. Here's energy reporter Daniel Mercer.
Connect and the light goes green.
At this farm in Kojonup, about 3 hours southeast of Perth, Nina and James Hope are feeling good about their decision to buy an EV last year.
So yeah, I said to Nina, our next car is always going to be an electric car. And we were just in Perth and had an afternoon spare. And I said, I'll go around to, and see what these cars are like. And they said, I'll come for a test drive. And I said, no, I'm just coming for a look. And they said, no, jump in. Off we went. And I was just, you know, blown away.
For Nina Hope, the decision was philosophical as much as anything else. But a big benefit has also been fuel and maintenance costs have fallen sharply.
We just thought it was the right thing to do at the right time. And we were able to, and it just made so much sense in the way we feel about energy at the moment.
Like the Hopes, more and more motorists are opting for an EV when they buy a new car. Will Edmonds is a renewable energy associate at Bloomberg New Energy Finance, and he says EVs made up about 2% of all new cars sold last year, up from less than 1% a year earlier. He also notes Labor came to office promising extra money for EVs, including a doubling of funding for new charging stations and cuts to fringe benefit and import taxes.
They believe their policies will help push electric vehicle sales
to 89% of all vehicle sales by 2030. That means they're banking on an incredible growth rate.
Will Edmonds isn't quite as optimistic. He says global supply chain disruptions are slowing production of EVs. And on top of that, he says car makers are shunning Australia where they're not required to meet minimum fuel efficiency standards.
Wait times for the Tesla Model 3, which is Australia's most popular electric vehicle, have blown out to 12 months. And then when it comes to other automakers, they're beginning to cancel existing models here. And it's only going to get worse. So Europe, China, and the US, their fuel emission standards ratchet up over time, meaning there's an increasing pressure on automakers to send vehicles there. If Australia doesn't have that fuel emission standard, it risks falling even more behind.
Tony Webber from the Federal Chamber of Automotive Industries backs calls for a fuel efficiency standard. He says it'd bring Australia into line with the rest of the developed world and benefit consumers as well as the environment.
What the government should do is not mandate that we should have electric vehicles or a percentage of hydrogen fuel cells or any other type of technology. What I say to the government is, you give us the CO2 target, we will give you the technology to meet that target.
Kojonup farmer James Hope says the absence of fuel efficiency standards is symptomatic of Australia's recent energy problems.
Yeah, we've just got to catch up with the rest of the world and be where we need to be. The technology's here. Supply's an issue, as in getting them, but this car is a fantastic car.
Kojonup farmer James Hope ending that report from Daniel Mercer. They're all smiles last night as the Prime Minister, State and Territory leaders posed for a selfie on the staircase at the lodge in Canberra. They shared dinner together ahead of their first meeting of National Cabinet today with Anthony Albanese at the head of the table. Health is one of the big items up for discussion. Governments are seeking more help from the Commonwealth to support a public hospital system groaning under the pressure of COVID. And they also want the system reformed. With more, here's Dana Morse.
2 years since it was first created, National Cabinet is set to meet for the first time under a new Prime Minister. And Anthony Albanese has put the big issues on the agenda.
I'll be discussing the whole range of issues. I'll discuss that with them tonight, as I'll discuss the way that we progress into the future.
For nearly all jurisdictions, health funding is the top priority. The former federal government made an agreement during the pandemic to split public hospital funding 50-50 with the states and territories. That arrangement is due to end in September, but the states want to see it extended. Victorian Premier Daniel Andrews says he and his New South Wales counterpart, Dominic Perrottet, will be fighting on the same front.
Health will be a really significant priority for me. I know it is for him as well. His health system is under very similar pressure to ours. And I want to be very clear with you, as I was with the Prime Minister last night, I will not settle for this Commonwealth government proceeding with Scott Morrison's cutbacks. I don't think that is appropriate.
South Australian Premier Peter Malinauskas won the recent state election on a platform of health reform. He sees an opportunity for broad changes.
We've got a situation on the National Health Funding Agreement that actually, in many instances, sees the hospital system working against the primary healthcare system. And we've got to start to talk about national reform, which means the Commonwealth and the states have to work together rather than just having an argument about the money.
The medical community says the pandemic is still very much a concern across the nation. Australian Medical Association President Dr. Omar Korshid says it's a critical moment for healthcare.
We critically need extension of the funding arrangement for COVID that the Commonwealth has put forward as a result of the pandemic. The national partnership funding is critical to the running of our hospitals today. COVID's going nowhere. We know we're going to be living with COVID for the foreseeable future, and our governments need to accept that, to build that into their plans and to build it into the funding model.
But it's not going to be easy for any government to meet the Premier's high expectations. The federal government is staring down a budget black hole, and Anthony Albanese says committing to any extra funding will be a stretch.
We inherit $1 trillion of debt with not much to show from it from the former government. We're not in a position to do everything we would like to do.
The Prime Minister Anthony Albanese ending that report by Dana Morse. Germany, France and Italy's leaders have visited Ukraine's capital together in an act of solidarity to support the country's bid to join the European Union. The three have also been criticised for not doing enough to help Ukraine, but its leaders have met face-to-face with President Volodymyr Zelensky, promising to rebuild the nation and help it join the EU. Europe correspondent Steve Kinnane reports.
Surrounded by a media pack and armed Ukrainian soldiers, French President Emmanuel Macron, German President Olaf Scholz, Italian Prime Minister Mario Draghi and Romanian President Klaus Iohannis all toured the city of Irpin, a place the German president said had become a symbol of the unimaginable cruelty and the senseless violence of the Russian war on Ukraine.
You can see from that side a lot of bullets.
The European leaders were shown the wreckage of a car that local officials say was targeted by Russian troops when a mother and children were inside. Emmanuel Macron said that Irpin was the scene of war crimes. The French president has been criticised in Ukraine in recent weeks for saying that the West must not humiliate President Putin. In Irpin, he defended his position. I've always been consistent, he said. France has always stood alongside Ukraine from day one, and President Zelensky himself has always wanted to talk with President Putin. Today, Ukraine must be able to resist and win. And so we stand alongside the Ukrainians with no ambiguity. And we are making progress. All four leaders said they were united in supporting Ukraine's bid to join the EU. At a joint press conference, President Zelensky said that Russia's attack on his country was an attack on all of Europe. Russia does not choose whom and when to threaten, whom in Europe to grant safety, he said. Russian aggression against Ukraine is aggression against all of Europe, against all united Europe, against every one of us, against our values. Our response must be united. Meanwhile, Russia's foreign ministry has announced it has sanctioned a further 121 Australian citizens, citing what it calls a Russophobic agenda in Australia. It's an eclectic and unusual list that includes mining magnate Gina Rinehart, Atlassian co-founder Mike Cannon-Brookes, chair of the ABC Ita Buttrose, and the author of The Fine Cotton Fiasco, Peter Hoisted. The individuals named will be barred from entering Russia indefinitely. This is Steve Kinnane reporting for AM.
The committee investigating the US Capitol riot last year has heard more extraordinary evidence, with one witness testifying the democracy came dangerously close to catastrophe. The spotlight's been shone on the actions of the former Vice President Mike Pence and his refusal to overturn the result despite incredible pressure. Here's North America correspondent Jade McMillan.
Moments after the US Capitol was breached by an angry mob of Donald Trump's supporters, the then Vice President was quickly evacuated to a secure location inside the building.
I hear that Pence just caved.
No.
If Pence caved, we're going to drag motherfuckers through the streets.
Yes.
I guess the hope is that there's such a show of force here that Pence will decide to do the right thing, according to Trump.
The January 6 committee was told rioters came within 12 metres of Mike Pence and that his life was in danger. But he refused to leave the Capitol, just as he'd refused to submit to relentless pressure from Donald Trump to overturn the results of the 2020 election. Committee Chairman Benny Thompson said his courage put him in tremendous danger.
Our democracy came dangerously close to catastrophe. When Mike Pence made it clear that he wouldn't give in to Donald Trump's scheme, Donald Trump turned the mob on him, a mob that was chanting, "Hang Mike Pence," a mob that had built a hangman's gallows just outside the Capitol.
The hearing was told Donald Trump latched onto a theory pushed by lawyer John Eastman that the vice president had the authority to obstruct the certification of the election results. Conservative heavyweight and retired judge Michael Luttig described the efforts as the most reckless and insidious failures in legal and political judgment in American history.
That declaration of Donald Trump as the next president would have plunged America into what I believe would have been tantamount to a revolution within a constitutional crisis in America the first constitutional crisis since the founding of the Republic.
Former advisers testified that John Eastman kept pursuing his plan despite conceding in front of Donald Trump that it wasn't lawful. They also detailed a phone call on the morning of January 6 in which the former president is alleged to have called Mike Pence a wimp. Posting on his own social media network, Donald Trump criticised the investigation as a one-sided, highly partisan witch hunt. But its work isn't over yet, with the committee vowing to expose more evidence against the former president next week. This is Jade McMillan in Washington, reporting for AM.
Traumatised staff, disengaged students and an education department either unable or unwilling to fix the problem. The ABC has obtained a letter signed by all the teachers at the Tennant Creek High School in the Northern Territory stating every single one of them feels unsafe at work. The letter shows a school at breaking point, describing an increase in violence towards teachers, low attendance rates and crippling staff shortages. The Tennant Creek High teachers want the best for their students, but they say they need urgent help to go on. Oliver Gordon has this exclusive report.
It's about as remote as it gets. Head north on the Stuart Highway from Alice Springs and 5 hours later you'll reach Tennant Creek. Right now, things in the town's only high school are at breaking point.
This school is traumatising for students and staff.
That's a teacher we'll call John, who provided a statement to the ABC on the condition of anonymity. John is one of the 17 teachers at Tennant Creek High School who last month penned a letter to the NT Education Department. It begins with these statements.
I feel unsafe at work. I'm not able to provide a safe learning environment for students. It is a challenge to carry on.
The letter draws attention to what is described as an escalation in critical incidents involving student violence, as well as staff shortages and extremely low morale within the teaching staff. Another teacher who spoke to the ABC on the condition of anonymity says police regularly attend the school to break up violence or attend break-ins. She says when violence breaks out at the school, teachers end up in the firing line.
Teachers are being assaulted in efforts to de-escalate student violence. This happens weekly.
Community leaders in Tennant Creek say more needs to be done to ensure the school's many Indigenous students are properly supported in class.
I'm traditional owner of Tennant Creek through my grandmother's side.
That's Patricia Frank, whose grandchildren will be attending Tennant Creek High in the coming years. She wants full-time cultural advisors in class to reduce disruptive behaviour.
Female and a male, so they can learn both ways, you know.
Saeed Amin is the Deputy Chief Executive of the NT's Department of Education.
That community feedback has been heard. We value it. We certainly welcome it. And we continue to work with local Aboriginal groups in that space.
How could you as a department let things get to this point where every single teacher is writing and signing a letter like this?
Oliver, I think it's something that we take extremely seriously. When concerns are expressed, we respond, and we have done that in this case.
Since receiving the letter, the department has met with Tennant Creek High staff on two occasions. It says it will move forward a whole school review, increase staff training and investigate the use of CCTV on the school site. Michelle Ayres leads the union representing the Tennant Creek High teachers.
You know, they're there because they want to see great outcomes for these children.
She says a teacher shortage across the NT is leaving many schools understaffed and is calling on the NT government to reverse its decision to freeze teachers' pay for 4 years.
I think it's actually a real possibility that if we don't see a change in this soon, we are going to be really in a dire situation.
But for John, one of the teachers who spoke to the ABC on the condition of anonymity, it's not about money. It's about having a safe place to work for students and teachers.
I care deeply for my students, but I constantly feel like I'm letting them down. We need to do a better job.
Teacher who spoke to the ABC on condition of anonymity, ending Oliver Gordon's report. That's AM for today. Thanks for your company. I'm Sabra Lane.
Hi, I'm Sam Hawley, host of the ABC News Daily podcast. You'd know by now we're in the middle of an energy crisis. There's such a massive shortage of power. We're being told to conserve energy, including by switching off our heating in the early evening. Today, energy expert Matthew Warren, whose career has spanned the gas, coal and renewable sectors, on how we got to this point and what could have been done to save us from the real threat of blackouts in the middle of winter. Look for the ABC News Daily podcast on the ABC Listen app.
You've been listening to an ABC podcast. Discover more great ABC podcasts, live radio, and exclusives on the ABC Listen app.